sorry. Defendant and appellant. For the respondent, Mr. Rose. For the appellant, Mr. Sirocco. Case number S042278, the people respondent, the Mary Ellen Samuels, appellant. For the appellant, Mr. Levine. And for the respondent, Mr. Brody.
We'll proceed initially in the matter of Marine Forest Society versus California Coastal Commission, hearing first from Mr. Barbieri.
Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Over 100 years ago, the Court upheld the legislature's power to appoint non-constitutional officers. It twice rejected separation of powers challenges and declared that the power of appointment is safer when exercised by the immediate representatives of the people rather than when lodged in the hands of the executive.
Counsel, what is the primary function of the Coastal Commission? Is it executive, legislative, or judicial?
The primary function of the Coastal Commission is probably quasi-adjudicative. That is, it issues permits and cease and desist orders, which are normally considered a quasi-adjudicative activity that many executive agencies perform. So we have said that the Commission is in the nature of an executive branch agency.
But is it appropriate for the legislature to be permitted to name a supermajority of that body?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And the reason it is essentially grounded in California's history, which from the very beginning of our constitutional history has afforded the legislature the power to appoint executive branch officers.
Mr. Barbieri, would you say that proposition is without limitation? Would it extend to each and every person in the executive branch, close associates or other appointees of the governor who might perform an executive function, or is it just that we do have many boards and commissions where, in fact, the legislature has had a recognized role in making those appointments?
Well, this case does concern independent boards and commissions, but in answer to your question, Your Honor, there are limitations on it. First of all, we're only talking about officers. So someone who is, a confidant of the governor, I mean, we're not talking about those kinds of persons. But with regards to persons who can carry out executive branch functions and who do, can be classified as officers, the legislature does have the power to appoint and has exercised that power over the years. Now, there's an additional limitation to that, which, of course, is that the governor has the power of veto over any law that the legislature passes. So this is not, in that sense, it's not an unfettered power. But from the standpoint of who gets to choose, our Constitution from the beginning has said that's the legislature to whom we entrust that authority in the first instance.
But legislature has appointed a member of the commission, does it not also, under the scheme that we're looking at, the scheme in which this case arose, have the power to remove commissioners whose decisions the legislature may not like?
Under the old scheme, that was certainly true. They could remove their appointees.
And that's the scheme that we're examining now.
There's a question as to what extent the old scheme is moot in light of the relief thought. But I'll answer the question as if it still is before the court. The answer is that yes. Again, historically, our Constitution has recognized the power of the legislature both to appoint and to determine the duration of an office, including removal. In fact, historically and constitutionally historically, in the absence of a term of office, the appointing authority was free to remove an appointee at will.
Are you really saying that the legislature has the power to remove its appointed members if they disagree with it?
Yes, I am.
How then does this not mean that the legislature is not controlling this commission?
All the legislature can do is decide who sits on the body. The legislature function begins and ends with deciding who gets to sit. The legislature does not get to direct the actions of its appointees. It does not get to extract concessions.
It gets to remove them when they disagree with them.
And yes, and the reason...
Isn't that the equivalent of what Justice Chin is asking you? If they can't control them, but they can remove them the day after, put somebody else in, and if that person does the same thing the legislature doesn't like, then you'd be able to remove that person too. And you say that's not the equivalent of a control?
That's correct, because the actual appointee who made the decision that offended the legislature made that decision, and the legislature did not control that decision. All that's happening in this hypothetical is that the legislature is replacing that person with someone else who reflects the legislature's philosophy. But that is inherent in a system that has recognized from the beginning that the power of appointment can be exercised by the legislature.
Well, Mr. Barbieri, it seems to me that we're discussing something that is somewhat beside the point, because not only did the legislature amend the law after the Court of Appeal struck it down, but it is a fundamental maxim of jurisprudence that when injunctive relief is sought, the reviewing court looks at the law as it exists at the time the matter is under submission to the appellate tribunal and not to the earlier one. So what we are faced with, is it not, is the scheme as amended by the legislation that was effective 2003. Isn't that the case?
That is our position, Your Honor, that the issue with regards to the old structure is moot, and the court doesn't need to reach that. We've expressed the reasons why in our supplemental letter. And to the extent we're just talking about the power to appoint, again, that has been the rule since literally the first day of statehood. And we point out some of the very first acts that the legislature ever performed was to set up agencies and to create officers for which it took either a majority of the appointments or all of the appointments. And consider again that this happened immediately after the Constitution was enacted in 49. I mean, the ink isn't even dry on the Constitution. The legislature, as we now know, is in San Jose, and they're immediately passing laws that allow them to exercise this power of appointment. 7 years later, in the Langdon case, the issue comes right to this court. And they raise the separation of powers argument that sounds very much like Marine Forest Society. I mean, these cases are so old that they still have the arguments of counsel before you get to the decision, and the arguments are pretty much the same. This court rejects the argument. They say there is no violation of the separation of powers, and they cite the language that I started with.
So, counsel, let me understand you, to see if I understand you. If the statute were still in front of us that said that the legislature has the power to remove if they disagree, your position is that that would be okay.
That is correct, Your Honor.
What test should we use in determining when the legislature goes beyond and violates the separation of powers?
Well, the test I would suggest is when the legislature... I think the line is drawn at appointment and removal if the legislation calls for removal. The legislature cannot exact concessions from its appointees. It cannot direct their decisions in any way. So it's a very clear line.
Let me pose a hypothetical to you. Let's assume that the legislature and the governor's office are controlled by the same political party, and that as a result of a recall or other type of election, the governor is defeated, but he's still a lame duck. And the legislature, under those circumstances, decides to extract revenge and to give the legislature the appointment power over all of the boards and commissions in California, and is promptly signed into law by the lame duck governor. As I understand your argument, that would be constitutional.
That's correct. Assuming your hypothetical, the governor would have no incentive to veto it. And the question then is, well, is there some kind of check on that kind of a legislative activity?
In other words, you would take that to the extreme of permitting the legislature to control the all of the appointments on all of the boards and commissions in California.
In theory, that is possible. In reality, it doesn't happen, one, because of the veto, and two, because...
We have a governor who's upset with the other party and wants to extract revenge. Now, what constitutional principle is there that would preclude that from happening?
Well, I assume we're not going to get into the actual motives, but we're going to look just to see whether there is constitutional power to do that. And the answer is that the legislature has that power, I mean, because it does have the power of appointment. So what's the check if the governor doesn't veto it? Well, the check, and I think this works well, excuse me, with your hypothetical.
Or it could be overridden.
That's true, too. But the check in that situation is the political process itself. I mean, if the legislature is going to take an act that seems high-handed like that, then there's a price to pay for it. And in a situation where we acknowledge where elected officials can be recalled, then the political process is the one to keep the legislature in line. And going back to this idea of the theoretical power, in fact, if we look at all the agencies that now exist in California, and there's, 100, 200, or 300, it's hard to even keep track of them, for the majority of those agencies, the governor has been given the power to appoint a majority of the officers. So as a practical matter, as the system has played out, the legislature hasn't had any incentive to try to monopolize the appointments. Sure, it has the
Wouldn't
theoretical...
Wouldn't we give them the incentive by ruling as you wish?
Well, I think one of the ironies...
And I particularly ask the question in light of the fact that the legislature tried to not only get a supermajority, but to get for themselves the power to dismiss upon disapproval of a vote.
Well, it's hard to know how the legislature might react in response to the court's ruling. I think one thing that's noteworthy is, as we point out, the system... I mean, in the first 60 years, there was a lot of litigation. After that, the system, it worked. I mean, there hasn't been a constitutional issue like this that I'm aware of for over 100 years.
Well, and in this case, I understand four votes, four appointments by the governor, four appointments by the Rules Committee, four appointments by the Speaker of the House. What if the legislature said, we want all of those appointments?
They could pass a law and say that they have all the appointments, assuming that
would be okay.
If the governor didn't veto it, that would become law.
But it seems a bit naive or idealistic to assume that the political process would take care of this, and that the governor 4 years hence would have to campaign in defense of what action had taken place, or the legislators would, or that somehow the people then would raise the money to put an initiative on the ballot to override that. Don't we need something more than faith in the political process to provide some kind of meaningful checks and balances?
Well, I think the answer is that the checks and the balances were struck at the very beginning, and that's why I felt compelled to actually quote your words back to you, because there was a philosophical decision made that this power of appointment was safer in the hands of the immediate representatives of the people rather than lodged in the hands of the executive.
The language that you just mentioned that the court come from? Is that this court's, 1859 decision or 1857
decision? 1857 decision. Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Barbieri, I gather that your argument to the court, in essence, comes down to point number one, at least as far as I understand your argument. You take the view that you have the state constitution on your side. I think earlier on in your argument, you made some very brief reference to it. I presume your view is that the state constitution of California in 1849 allowed the legislature to direct how appointments were to be made. And then I think as I was listening to the rest of your argument, you pointed out that decisions of this court, including the Langdon decision, and I think then thereafter was the Freeman decision, have upheld that power or that authority of the legislature. Is it of any significance that after the original enactment of the Constitution, which allowed the legislature to have a say in appointments, that at the 1879 convention, the Constitutional Convention, there was one delegate who urged that that appointment be taken away, but he didn't get the votes. And as a result, presumably your argument is you have on your side the state constitution as originally enacted. You have on your side, based upon your argument, the various cases of this court that have said it is not an express violation of the separation of powers to allow, under certain circumstances, and I presume with certain limitations, the authority of the legislature to make certain appointments. Is that basically,
That's correct, in essence,
your view?
Yes.
Is it any significant that when one takes a look at the various constitutions of the states in this nation, a majority of the courts in the various sister states that have considered the issue have said that given their particular state constitutions, there is no problem in allowing, under certain circumstances, the legislature to make certain appointments.
Yes. Yes, it's, I mean, it's our position that California is in the mainstream with regards to its view of the legislature's power of appointment.
Counsel, assuming we agree with you that the current scheme is constitutional, but we disagree as to whether or not the prior scheme was constitutional, what is the effect of any ruling in your favor with respect to prior decisions of the commission? Are those still valid, or can those be challenged?
If the court were to find that the original system was unconstitutional,
yes.
In our view, it would not affect the validity of those decisions. With regards to the decisions for which the statute of limitations has run, that is, there's the 60-day statute of limitations in the Coastal Act, those are time-barred. Those are most of the cases that we're talking about. There are, I think, approximately 20 cases that are active, and that challenged the commission decision under the old structure. With regards to those decisions, we believe that those decisions of the commission should be granted validity under the de facto officer doctrine. And the reason for that is that that where there is a collateral attack on a past decision, that the courts have said we're going to give. Those decisions were made under color of law, and we're not going to invalidate them. So while you may be entitled to prospective relief to change in the future, we're not going to go back and undo a scheme that everyone relied on. It's our view that because the de facto officer doctrine applies, the court doesn't even really need to reach the old structure.
You said there were approximately 20 active cases. What does active mean? If they're still in the process of appealing whatever ruling was made, would they not be able to challenge the composition of the commission that made that ruling?
I suppose that's true. It would be hard to say without knowing specifically how the issue is percolating up. Most of the cases that I'm referring to are in the trial courts. I think a lot of the trial courts are kind of waiting for the outcome of this decision. And I think, for example, with regards to the Marine Forest Zone claim, there's maybe some contention about whether it's trying to undo the past Coastal Commission decision that affects it. I think if the court were to say it's that Marine Forest Society is unable to go back and collaterally attack the commission's decision based on the former structure, that would give the guidance to the other courts to know they don't need to reach the issue of the commission's former structure either. So,
but if you went back to everything ever decided, I mean, there could be, by some estimates, more than 100,000 decisions made by the Coastal Commission that would be called into question if you didn't put any limitation on, wouldn't there be?
Oh, that's correct, Ryan. We're not suggesting. We're saying that almost all of those decisions are dead in the water. We're just talking about the 20 or so that are still pending. I think almost all of them are in the trial courts. right now. So I think that the court doesn't need to decide the old issue, the old structure, if it indicates to those courts that those decisions should be given de facto validity because the commission did issue them under color of law.
But if you wouldn't know, but just to conclude this thought, if the individuals appealing to the trial court, the decisions that we're talking about, had challenged the composition of the committee, why would the de facto officer doctrine apply?
Because the doctrine doesn't allow someone to collaterally attack, that is, to challenge a decision based on the infirmity of the officers making the decision. All the relief anybody would be entitled to do is to have a direct challenge to the validity of the agency, but now the agency has been reconstituted. It's of a different dimension.
Mr.
Barbieri,
go ahead.
O'Brien decision has any application in this case?
No, I don't, Your Honor. And the reason for that actually is very helpful for understanding this case. In O'Brien, the court was O'Brien concerned this court's inherent power to determine the composition of the state bar court and to appoint bar court judges. That the court's inherent power. When the California legislature attempted to legislate in that area, there was a risk that it was impairing this court's core function to make that determination. And as a result of that, the court had to analyze whether there was a material impairment or not. And to avoid that, the court found sufficient safeguards to protect that outcome. In this situation, and this is very important, the governor has no inherent power of appointment. The court has said that before, and if you look to the Constitution itself, Article 5, Section 5, it says that the only constitutional power that the governor has is to fill a vacancy, and even then, only when the legislature permits it. So the governor's constitutional appointment power is almost imperceptible.
And is it your view that the executive doesn't have any core or inherent powers which the legislature has to respect? In other words, that only that which is specifically defined in the Constitution as a constraint on them, and otherwise they can do whatever they want with respect to the executive?
Well, I wouldn't say anything they want, but I would say, unlike the court, which has identified many inherent core functions, the governor doesn't have it. And I would go back to 1856 in the Jewett case. They even say that whereas the legislature's power is plenary, the governor only has the power that the Constitution grants to the governor. And I did do a search to see, are there other decisions in which the court has said that there are inherent executive powers? The only case I could find, I don't remember the name, but concerned the governor's power with regard to parole decisions. But other than that, I've never seen any other suggestion of inherent executive powers.
Well, the governor is the head of the executive branch of California state government, is he not?
That's correct.
And with that responsibility, doesn't it stand to reason that there are certain inherent powers that go with it in order to perform that function?
There very well may be, Your Honor, but the one power that we can say for sure doesn't go along with it is the power of appointment, because this court has already said in Freeman and Langdon that it's not an inherent executive power, and the constitutional provision to which I referred said, again, narrows that power. And just one more comment, I'm sorry. In this court, in the Lundgren case back in 1988, said the governor in our Constitution has no general power of appointment. So this issue, it's not like this is dead law. This is still...
Is it significant that we're dealing with an area that is not something that traditionally or historically was within the governor's functions, let alone core functions, but that rather the permitting of land use in the coastal area was a function of local entities before the Coastal Act initiative and then the Coastal Act passed by the legislature? Do you think that is a relevant consideration?
I hadn't given it any thought. I mean, it does suggest that the types of powers that the legislature or that the commission is exercising is not typical powers that we associate with maybe the state executive. So that might be an additional consideration.
Some other jurisdictions have taken into account various factors in determining whether or not there is a violation of the separation of powers, and one of them has been the nature of the power. Another one is the degree of control. A third one is the intent of the legislature. Should we take into account the intent of the legislature?
Although your time is up, Mr. Barbieri, you may respond to Justice Quinn's questions.
I would say no, only to the extent that you're trying to construe what it intended in a particular piece of legislation. But I think our position, again, is that the Constitution does allow the legislature in the first instance to create offices and to exercise the power of appointment if it chooses. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Barbieri. Mr. Zumbrum, half of respondent.
Chief Justice George, Associate Justices, I'm Ronald Zumbrun of the Zumbrun Law Firm in Sacramento. I represent the plaintiff and respondent, Marine Forest Society, and its president, I have a blank in my name, Rodolph Streichenberger. And with me today is also Mark Kay of the Zumbrun Law Firm, who will be assisting me.
Mr. Zumbrun, before you get into many of the rather difficult issues, I wonder if you would be kind enough to shed some light on the O'Brien case, because as I recall, you placed heavy reliance on this court's 2000 decision in O'Brien. And as you have heard from opposing counsel, the opposing side takes the view that our decision in O'Brien doesn't help you at all. Naturally, you would disagree. And I would like to hear from you if you can put in succinct terms the reason for your disagreement with the opposing counsel.
The O'Brien case, which is decided in year 2000, recognizes that the separation of powers clause deals with power and safeguards. So in our case, there's a power, the majority superpower, with no safeguards. In the O'Brien case, there was some power of the legislature, but endless safeguards. And so in Bryan, where you had the beginning of a separation of powers situation, the court, in judging its own responsibility for the state bar court, and recognizing that now two legislators' appointees would be on the court recognized that first the court had the power of deciding if these appointees were qualified.
Well, apart from qualification, would you agree, taking a quick look at the O'Brien case, that there one of the primary issues was what was involved in that particular case, the disciplining of attorneys? And this court, majority of this court, pointed out that the discipline of attorneys is inherently and primarily a function of the court. Now, taking a look at that language, taking a look at this particular case, how, for purposes of oral argument, what would support your view that O'Brien does indeed help you? Because I think that to follow up on a question from the Chief Justice when opposing counsel was at the podium, I think the Chief Justice pointed out that taking a look at the circumstances of this particular case, land use planning, certainly there's nothing in the California Constitution that would have given the power to appoint pertaining to land use planning to the governor, nor is there anything before the 1975 enactment of the Coastal Act, anything that shows that decisions pertaining to land use planning within the coastal zone was traditionally overseen by the state executive branch. So I think when one takes a look at these distinctions, one could reasonably conclude that the appointment at issue here does not affect a core function.
Yes,
of the executive.
The Supreme Court has a core function of dealing with the state bar court. The Supreme Court had a situation of, is there an interference with our power? Is there a violation of separation of powers clause? And then the court went to the safeguards that were present and concluded that there weren't. Now, in our case, we're talking about the executive branch of government. And the executive branch of government has a duty of implementing the Coastal Act.
But again, my question was really trying to get a response to what is your argument that, I mean, what is your response to the argument that one can reasonably make that here, given the reasons I just outlined, which I won't repeat because you may be running out of time pretty soon, that the core executive function has not been impaired by the appointments at issue?
Fine. First of all, land use and private property are part of the core powers of the executive branch of government in implementing the Coastal Act. The Coastal Act even requires that. Secondly,
But what about the Chief Justice's comment that matters of land use planning traditionally have fallen within the province of local government entities?
Well, they have traditionally, but in the Coastal Act, it moved a state agency into the major power position and gave the power of two-thirds of the appointments to the legislature and provided no safeguards. The Coastal Commission was placed in the executive branch of government but does not answer to the Secretary of Resources, doesn't answer to anyone in the executive branch of government.
But there was no pre-existing history or tradition prior to the 1970s, I think that's the point of Justice Kennard's question, of that function being lodged in the state executive entity.
The legislature can't implement and conduct the Coastal Commission. The judiciary can't implement. The judiciary can adjudicate. It doesn't matter when you have these new entities formed, they go into one of the three branches of government.
What's the significance of the fact that there are several other boards where the legislature of California appoints the majority?
There are none. There are no other substantive boards or commission presently in the state of California that have their majority appointed by the legislature. Those that have their majority appointed by the legislature are doing legislative functions. They're part of the legislative branch of government. So, and the Coastal Commission at the trial and appellate court were unable to come up with any example of the majority of a current state agency exercising executive powers had the majority appointed by the legislature. And that
so your argument is premised upon the fact that this is executing executive functions,
yes,
as opposed to those boards that have a majority appointed by the legislature that, in your view, do not perform executive functions.
Right, and there'll be more new boards coming in, and they'll fall in one of those three areas, and they cannot have power and no safeguards and being able to intrude on each other because that is a violation of separation of powers. They also cannot intrude, the legislature cannot intrude on other constitutional provisions when they use their appointments power. For example, if they set up a scheme where minorities could not serve on a certain board, that'd be unconstitutional as a violation of equal protection. Similarly, if they do appointments that violate the separation of powers clause, that's a constitutional violation, and they don't have that power.
Let me ask you about something different, Mr. Zumbrum. Your briefing relies substantially upon the support you find in the federal constitution and some of the federal decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Vallejo. Isn't it a fact, though, that the Buckley case and other decisions construing a much stricter separation of powers under the federal constitution than exists in California and most other states relied substantially on the fact that in Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2, the executive in the U.S. Constitution is given a specific power of appointment, and that power is not conferred by the California Constitution, nor is it conferred by most of the other state constitutions. And We have even the extreme. I know my colleague, the Chief Justice from South Carolina, informed me that she and the other members of her court are appointed by the legislature, not by the governor. So we have a broad array of different schemes, and it's a mistake, isn't it, to try to import in a wholesale way principles of federal separation of powers jurisprudence, which are not applicable to the states being governed by their own state constitutional provisions.
Well, we are not challenging the appointments power exercise in this situation. We're challenging the separation of powers, which is a totally different thing.
Yes,
we are
but
not
the authority that you cite in support of your position is premised upon that appointments clause in the federal constitution, a clause that has no application to the state of California.
We are not
correct.
But we are not relying on federal law regarding appointments. And we also feel that the federal law regarding the separation of powers on, based on federal law is not necessarily binding on this court. What we are relying on are those federal cases that this court has chosen to follow, particularly in O'Brien and the Carmel Valley case, just recent cases. And when this court more or less adopts the philosophy of the Boucher case that the appointee if subject to the an at-will appointment, is beholden to the person who is appointing. If they're on a fixed term and they're subject to reappointment, they're addressing that. There's a human nature, common sense belief that this court has adopted from those cases that there are powers that are being utilized by the legislature. For example, and none of us would argue that the populace does not have some say in the activities of the people they elect. Take a state senator as a four-year term. He's paying attention to that populace, particularly as he gets to the end of his term and wants to be reelected. Same thing applies to the coastal commissioner. They're, as they get to the end of that term, they are trying to please their appointed power, or they're not going to be back. And that's a power. Now, what are the safeguards to protect? There are no safeguards. I covered the no powers of the executive. There's no ability, there's no power to terminate a coastal commissioner even for cause in either branch of the government. They're not supervised. There's no checks of their qualifications. They are there, and the only existence of power is in the appointment process. And like in the O'Brien case, there was all kinds of protections for the separation of powers. We're not challenging the commission's, we're not saying the commission goes out of existence. We're not arguing that. We're not arguing that commissioners haven't been appointed properly, because they have. They have exceeded their powers that they can have if the legislature controls. They can only exercise legislative powers. And here they are also exercising quasi-judicial and executive. And that's why we're asking the court for a remedy to follow the lead of the trial and court of appeal and issue an injunction against the Coastal Commission exercising judicial and executive powers. And included in that would be issuing cease and desist orders, denying permits or conditioning permits and other executive and judicial function.
What can they do? Put out pretty brochures? Is that about the limit of their activities?
They can,
what else can they do?
The rulemaking power is policy, and that's a legislative grant of delegation to the commission. They can continue to do rulemaking, to set policy controlled by the California Coastal Act. If they want to do more, it's going to require further legislation, because the corrective legislation that took place, the legislature, the Court of Appeals said there's three deficiencies. One, the at-will appointment. Two, the two-thirds appointment. And three, the lack of checks and balances. And those have only the will appointment has been eliminated. As opposed to the others still stand. You also have the issue of what happens to the fact in this case that the finding of violation of separation powers it disturbs the law in this area, because the commission would have been found not to have subject matter jurisdiction. This is very serious. When the restatement of laws that we cited in our final reply supplemental brief, when they first addressed lack of subject matter jurisdiction, they dropped it. They didn't even act and make recommendations. The second restatements came out, and they indicated that there should be a balancing process where the courts look at, has res judicata applied? Had this been previously been heard? Has are there other factors? And the court goes through a balancing process and then concludes, can this case go further? And particularly the restatement of judgments, Section 12, and conflicts of law, Section...
Let me ask you the same question I asked opposing counsel. There, in other jurisdictions, other courts in the Bennett case, for instance, other courts have laid out certain factors the court should look at in determining whether or not there is separation of powers. One of those factors is the intent of the legislature. Do you think it's appropriate for courts to look at the intent of the legislature in determining whether or not it has overstepped?
I think the intent of the legislature is something that gets into the mix. If the legislature is clearly making a power grab, I think it would have a major impact. If it's something in a more subtle area, the courts have to look at the entire picture.
For instance, in the Bennett case, the third consideration of importance was the intent of the legislature. Was it the intent of the legislature to cooperate with the executive by furnishing some special expertise of one of its members or one or more of its members, or was it the objective of the legislature, one of establishing its superiority over the executive department?
A lot of that would depend on what is the nature of what this person is doing. Are these legislative functions making that available?
That's another one of the factors that the Bennett
right.
case talked about,
but
the nature of the power.
Yeah, but if they're...
But I'm talking about the intent of the legislature.
Yeah, but if the intent...
Does it have any relevance?
If the intent... It has some relevance. If the intent is to take someone from the legislative branch and to perform executive branch functions, that's highly suspect, and we should go into the whole process. But if they're taking an expert and having them perform expertise which is in the legislative province, that may pass muster, because is that person going to have control of the executive? Are there safeguards? And we have to go into those.
Why, in your view, doesn't the new scheme, which has a fixed four-year term and elimination of the at-will provision, doesn't that sort of remove the legislature from the perils of day-to-day interference with the commission?
No, and that's because no one has any controls except the legislature, which is still appointing two-thirds of the voting commissioners. Plus, there's no safeguards. And plus, they reappoint them. That combination is an intrusion on the implementation of the Coastal Act and the powers of the executive.
Go ahead.
Mr. Zumbrin, Mr. Barbieri said basically the executive has no inherent or core functions that belong only to the executive. I assume that you don't agree with that.
No, I don't. The executive has a core function of implementing the laws that the legislature passes, and those are major functions. And that's what we're talking about. When the legislature gets into interfering with the implementation of the laws, which they cannot do, we get into separation of powers, and we get into this whole process.
Mr. Zumbrin, a few minutes ago, you were somewhat dismissive of the circumstance that there are boards where the legislature appoints a majority of the members, and I believe you viewed those
cases as involving entities that were not really executive in nature. And I just wondered what your view was of the decision of this court in People versus Freeman, where the legislature appointed all five members of the state library board, and the governor urged in his words in that case that appointing to the office is intrinsically, essentially, and exclusively an executive function and therefore cannot be exercised by the legislature. And this court unanimously rejected the governor's position. Now, would you distinguish that case?
I would rely on some of the language in the case, but because the court made a distinction between if they were appointing in a pure executive branch and they're appointing a majority, that would raise separation of powers. That may raise separation of powers issues. Here, the function was not executive in nature. It was legislative in nature.
Well, the governor thought it was executive. That's, you know, I quoted his argument to the Supreme Court.
But the Supreme Court made a distinction between executive functions and the functions in that case. So that lends weight to my argument, I hope. And it also is not an example of the current separation of powers. Well, actually, it is the way I read it. But the current separation of powers jurisprudence has gone much further, in particularly dealing with the concept of control and the concept of absence of safeguards.
Do you agree with the view taken by the Court of Appeal that allowing the legislature to appoint a majority of the members of the commission would give the legislature way too much influence in the day-to-day workings of the commission?
Yes.
All right. Given that answer, what is your response to the argument? Well, as a matter of political reality, it's unlikely that a commission has been or will be improperly subservient to the legislature, because it's not one person in the legislature that can get rid of a particular person or appoint a particular person. It will take the various members that make up the Senate Rules Committee, and of course then there is the Speaker of the Assembly. And I think initially it was pointed out from the bench, or a comment was made about not everyone will be or may be of the same political party. Isn't that significant?
Well, any commissioner who crosses paths with the leadership of the legislature is in trouble for maintaining his position, whether there's at-will appointments or whether there's reappointments. It's back to Boscher. It's human nature. It's common sense. People are concerned about their future and reappointments. And it's I think it's common sense that that would be an influence on a normal human being. I'm not saying Coastal commissioners are normal human beings, but
isn't it significant that half of the commissioners must be selected from the regional commissions, and in turn those regional commissioners are made up of persons that have been nominated by local public entities?
Well, as the District Court of Appeal in this case noted, that the appointed powers can reject any of those recommendations and can send them back for new recommendations, and they have some control over those.
You know, your argument, I think, loses impact in the face of term limits, because now with the change in the legislation that governs appointments to the Postal Commission, the legislation effective in 2003, the appointees receive four-year terms, those appointed by the legislature. Now, can't we note that most speakers of the Assembly and pro tems of the Senate, who constitute part of the Rules Committee, really don't
have the longevity even that the members of the Coastal Commission have now with four-year terms. The speakers come and go, often after a year or two, and by the time their four-year term is up, there may be, you know, there may have been one or two changes in the speakership.
There's a change of power, and it's very possible, but the reappointment, it has a new power to address. And if the if he hasn't been performing according to the desires of the new power, he's going to have some problems. It may be a change of philosophical beliefs in the process, but that's still, there's a power base.
Well, how would you get around that? I mean, you wouldn't give them life appointments, I'm sure. Even we in the state courts don't have what our federal colleagues have. How do you get around the fact that whenever the term comes up, however long that term may be, that person's tenure may not suit the new person in the appointing power?
You get the legislature out of the position of appointing a supermajority of the Coastal Commission, and that power and that need for checks and balances from intrusion by the legislature disappears. The legislature had a chance to do that. They didn't. They have to get out of the position, or they have to put in safeguards that make it work. The Coastal Commission is subject to political influence. Their decisions are not consistent. They're erratic. They're not fair. And this is all tied to the separation of powers process.
But our Constitution provides, in terms of appointment powers, in stark contrast to the federal Constitution, that the appointment power is basically in the legislature, except we're limited by statute.
By the Constitution.
And there's no specific constitutional limitation. So in the absence of that, you have to rely upon an application of general concepts of separation of powers plus anything that legislation may have placed by way of limitation on a particular appointment. Is that correct?
Not completely, Your Honor. The original constitutional provision said that the legislature has the power to establish agencies, and I think that's a core function. They also have the power to describe the scheme or the system of appointments. It stops there. It goes on and says it provided is consistent with the Constitution. It doesn't say anything on the subject of appointing themselves or making appointments. That would go to their general powers, which are subject to the Equal Protection Clause, the Separation of Powers Clause, that all this Constitution.
But it doesn't give it to the governor either, and it doesn't impose any limitations explicitly or expressly on the legislature either, does it?
Right, but that means, because it's not expressed, doesn't mean they don't have the power. We're not challenging their exercise of the appointments power. What we're saying is that it doesn't trump the California Constitution, and where it does, this court has been given the obligation and duty to the public to stop violations of separation of powers clause.
But the trumping of the Constitution, in your words, lies totally, on your theory, in a rather inchoate separation of powers argument as opposed to anything explicit or express. Is that correct?
It's power and lack of safeguards. That's what violates the separation of powers.
But isn't the Chief Justice correct that the likelihood of mischief is substantially reduced by the term limits of legislators?
It's certainly not as draconian, but the power is still there. The Coastal Commissioner doesn't have to answer to anybody in the executive, doesn't have to answer to anybody in the judiciary. He's worried about the legislature and what the legislature wants, and he knows he's got to address his electorate when it comes up to reappointment, and it has a natural human nature impact. The United States Supreme Court saw that, made it clear. The District Court of Appeal here saw it. I read into the decisions of this court the adoption of that belief in the Brosher case and also in the some of the other leading cases.
But, Mr. Sombram, as you may recall, Mr. Barbieri has argued that, number one, He's got the state constitution on his side.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear
you. You may recall that Mr. Barbieri argued earlier that, number one, he has the state constitution on his side. I would imagine that would be a very powerful ally, wouldn't you?
Unless he's violating separation of powers, and it's just my side.
But in light of the argument made by Mr. Barbieri, and to follow up on the questioning by the Chief Justice of you just a few minutes ago, this is what the hurdle that you would have to overcome is this. The California Constitution imposes no absolute prohibition against the legislature's appointment and removal of executive branch officers. Also, it shows that, as was argued at the outset by Mr. Barbieri, this court has consistently upheld the exercise of that power. And on top of all this, this is in line with practices and decisions in the majority of sister states. Now, how do you overcome that hurdle? So far, I don't think you have done that, and you can still do that now.
Let me take
Although your time is up, you may respond to Justice Kennard.
Let me take Mr. Barbieri's most extreme position. He believes the legislature can appoint all members of all executive agencies. Now, where do you get that? That's not in the Constitution. That's something that the legislature now has created, and it has to be tested by the balance of the California Constitution. And number one in our system of government and the national system of government is the recognition that three branches of government exist and have to honor each other and not interfere. And if the legislature is appointing all the powers of the executive in these commissions, then the legislature is directly controlling the implementation of the law. What if they did the same in the judicial area? They can't exercise any judicial powers under the cases. And the theme that Mr. Barbieri is using is old cases, either where separation of powers was not a clause or not an issue, or where the legislative committee was involved, and ignoring that even today, no executive agency in the state of California, except for the Coastal Commission, is governed by a supermajority appointed by the legislature. And if that is in control, and that's what we're talking about, separation of powers, it's power, control, and safeguards. And that's our argument.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Zamora.
Thank you.
Mr. Barbieri, you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal argument.
Mr. Barbieri, could you start by answering the last question posed by opposing counsel, or at least that opposing counsel attributed to you, that the legislature can appoint all members of, let's not say everything in the world, let's say state commissions.
The legislature,
the only limitation on that, the veto power of the governor.
The only constitutional limitation would be the veto power of the governor. But as I said, as a practical matter, the legislature hasn't done that, and there's good political reasons why it hasn't done it. So it's truly a hypothetical problem. I understand that there's a constitutional point you're trying to make, and that's correct. In theory, it could be done, but it hasn't done because the legislature has more sense than that. Because
they haven't had a roadmap to do it.
Well, I think, as I pointed out, in fact, this system has really worked harmoniously for the past 160 years. The governor and the legislature are not involved in this lawsuit.
In this case, the legislature backtracked after they received the Court of Appeal opinion regarding the removal of coastal members who disagreed.
That's correct, and I think that was in response to a fear that
the commission would cease to function until this issue was resolved. So the legislature made the decision it was better to try to meet the concerns of the Court of Appeal than create potential chaos by having that issue linger for the next year or two while this issue was...
Mr. Barbieri, your opposing counsel doesn't feel that the legislature has cured the problem, and without your necessarily answering that, I would like you to respond to what was almost his closing statement. If the legislature is appointing the commissioners, which it is controlling implementation of the law, and that is a violation of separation of powers in this context.
Thank you. I mean, that expresses the fundamental flaw in their case. The legislature's power with regards to appointment begins and ends with the exercise of the appointment power. That's all we're talking about. The legislature can put the people on the bench.
And this does not control what they do, because if they don't please the legislature, they're not going to be, under the old scheme, they could be removed. Under the new one, they are not going to be renewed.
Well, I don't know if I would just say please. I mean, or if there's any number of reasons why someone might be removed. But the point is, once we've made the determination that this power is safer with the hands of in the legislature, then to a certain degree, these people on executive commissions are going to reflect the philosophy of the legislative branch. That doesn't mean they can tell them what to do, but philosophically, they can be in line with the legislature.
Don't you think it's significant that under the new legislation, effective 2003, members of the Coastal Commission, in effect, have a more secure tenure than recent history has shown us speakers of the Assembly and pro tems might have under term limits?
Well, that is certainly correct, Your Honor, which brings me to a related point with regards to this potential subservience, and that was one of the Bowser-type arguments. The fear of removal would improperly influence decision-making. And what that argument forgets, and one of 10 reasons why Bowser doesn't apply, is that the commissioners are independent. They don't have unfettered discretion to follow the whims of their appointing authorities. They have a Coastal Act to follow. Their decisions have to be based on evidence. They have to be conducted at a public hearing. Findings have to be made. There has to be written findings. Those findings have to be supported by evidence, and all of that gets reviewed by the courts. And so if they're going to do what they've been asked to do, what they've sworn to do, they're going to follow the law, and they're going to disregard any perceived displeasure of their appointing authority, even assuming they can divine in any case what it is that their appointing authority wanted them to do. So I think the court has a choice then, if you get to this removal issue, is are we going to presume the best in the people that we've appointed to do the job, or are we going to presume that they're going to disregard all these safeguards and act simply to please their appointing authority?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Barbieri. Your time is up. Thank you, Mr. Zumbrum. The matter stands submitted.